I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to tonight's edition of Mind Over Matter, a monthly Monday evening radio show that is dedicated to making our Southeast Alaska listeners' lives hopefully more mindful and filled with meaning. Brain injuries are usually invisible to others, but if you have had a brain injury, it may well alter your life forever. Far from invisible to the person who's had one, the ramifications of treatment, rehabilitation, and acceptance are daunting. So we're very fortunate today, or this evening, visiting Juneau for just a day is Dr. Amy Murphy, a physician, a certified brain injury specialist, and the medical director of Anchorage's Providence Hospital Brain Injury Services. So let me welcome Dr. Amy Murphy to the show. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand that to be a brain injury specialist, it's a very small group of people who are certified in this way, and you're the only specialist in Alaska. Is that true?
That is correct.
So tell me what brought you here.
So we, I did most of my work and training in the D.C. area, and D.C. is not known for its fantastic winters. We have friends who live in Alaska, so we would come up every year in the wintertime to visit and get our snow fix. And at one point I decided I'd like to live in Alaska. I called and found that there was no one in our subspecialty that lived up here, and so I called Providence, being the largest healthcare system, and asked if they would like a brain injury medicine specialist.
Wow, so you came up for the snow?
Yes.
Because you're a skier?
Well, because I'm a snow lover.
Oh. Okay, well, I can see why you didn't end up in Juneau, because we're getting less and less snow and more rain. So give us a little bit history of your training and your background and just how you got into brain injury as a specialty. What happened?
So as far as history, I was in the Navy during Desert Storm, and someone very close to me sustained a severe traumatic brain injury during that time. And there are many life lessons I'm sure that anyone who sustained a brain injury knows. And anyone who has loved someone who sustained a brain injury also knows of the other life lessons that you learn. And so that initiated my interest in brain injury as a treatment. Unfortunately, if you fast forward, there wasn't a lot done within that field other than some of the very basic research that came out for beginning rehabilitation. But the focus really wasn't there. The subspecialty hadn't really formulated to its entirety for quite some time. And so when I decided to actually go to medical school and do the training for brain injury, it was just in its infancy. And so either through the specialty of physical medicine and rehabilitation, which was my original specialty, or the specialty of neurology, you could go and then further do a fellowship and subspecialize in brain injury medicine. And so I did my medical training at the Virginia College of Osteopathic Medicine out in Blacksburg, Virginia, near Virginia Tech, and worked quite a bit with the sports medicine group out there, as well as brain injury medicine group out there. And then the rest of my training, I was at Walter Reed for some time, worked there in the brain injury medicine clinic, and then I eventually finished up and received my subspecialty training through, it's a combination of Georgetown University Hospital and National Rehabilitation Hospital down in Washington, D.C.
Amy, what were you doing in Desert Storm? What was your role in the Navy?
Oh, when I was in the Navy, I was actually enlisted. I had just gotten out of high school. So
really?
Yes, so I wasn't
wow.
I wasn't doing anything from a specialty standpoint. I was just like, you know, so many others stationed on a ship. And so it wasn't that my friend wasn't injured in combat. He was actually involved in a car accident when a deer stepped in front of his car on a ride home.
Okay. Why don't we Why don't we get into just some general notions of or explanation of traumatic brain injuries? Could you give us the gamut for of what causes them?
Absolutely.
What happens?
Absolutely. And so just, you know, in brain injury, you can have traumatic or acquired brain injury. You can also have what's called an anoxic brain injury, and that covers quite a bit of ground. So anoxic brain injury occurs when there's a lack of oxygen to the brain. This can happen if somebody has any type of cardiac event that is going on for a long time. This can happen for anything that just depletes oxygen from the brain.
Placenta abrupta.
Correct.
The placenta detaches before birth.
So anything that would interrupt supply to the brain. Now, as far as acquired brain injury, you can see this occur quite a bit with people that have tumors, either primary to the brain or secondary to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it in people that have had to take medications that can cause injury to the brain, such as different chemotherapeutic agents. So there are a lot of things that can give you an acquired brain injury. Traumatic brain injury is simply it comes because there's some type of external force to the head that is creating injury in the brain. And one of the biggest issues that a lot of people face today, especially people in high velocity, like car accidents and so forth, there doesn't need to necessarily be a blow to the head. It can be simply from a high velocity rotational force of somebody being in a car that stops quickly in an accident, but that is still an external force coming through the brain.
Because I think what people picture is you've got the skull,
right,
and then the brain knocks up against the skull.
Correct. So you don't need to necessarily hit the steering wheel or even hit anything with blunt force to the head, just the speed of the movement alone, the starting and stopping, can be enough to create a head injury.
Okay.
And then, of course, all of the other things we think about, direct blows to the head, sports injuries, you know, with any type of blows to the head and so forth, all of those can create a traumatic brain injury, and there are different levels of severity.
And I assume do assessment. So let's take something that might be fairly commonplace. It certainly is in my family, which is head injury through soccer accidents. In fact, several years ago, my son was playing in Anchorage. I wish you had been there, because it was, I think, before your time. And he was unconscious on the field, the soccer field, for an undetermined amount of time. I wasn't there. And he was rushed off to the ER, probably at Providence. So this is the classic soccer injury. So let's talk about sports injuries.
And sports injuries are a hot topic.
Yeah.
And, you know, in many ways, it's what really has shed some light for brain injury and has been a source of inspiration for brain injury survivors and their families, because now we know there are more people looking at it, there's more interest and now more research and just greater public awareness. Sports injuries have gained quite a bit of attention because there have been a few football players, notably Junior Seau, who have had sustained multiple concussions, which are mild traumatic brain injuries, throughout the course of their career. And then they had this period where they were doing fairly well, and then later on they started to develop these significant symptoms. And so in the beginning of the course, whenever these first started and you had the Players Association coming forward, people were saying, well, this is nothing that had anything to do with your head injury. And so in Junior Seau's case, he actually committed suicide. And he basically let his family know he had done it in a way to preserve his brain because he wanted people to look at it so that the world would understand what had happened to him so that it wouldn't happen to future players. And he was one of the first autopsy brains done through the National Institute of Health, where they found the evidence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. The most commonly known is Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yes.
And so we see the potential for permanent damage coming from these sports concussions, which has led to a lot of public interest. And so what we're looking at now is what do we do as far as treatment? What do we do as far as prevention? And the number one question I get from families is, how many are too many? You know, what is that magic number?
Is there a magic number?
There is not.
I figured. It's cumulative, isn't it?
Well, we definitely know that it's cumulative. We know that the more concussions that you sustain, and it doesn't matter if it's from sports or just, you know, car accidents, ATV accidents,
yeah,
snow machine, the more that you sustain, the more difficult it is to recover from each successive accident. However, when it comes to how many hits does it take before someone develops chronic traumatic encephalopathy, we don't know, because each brain is different. Some people have protective mechanisms that they can have more head injuries and not have any symptoms. Sometimes we're seeing them in as little as one, two, or three hits. And so there's been a lot of studies done, especially in Europe and in Canada. They're seeing some beginnings of the disease after just a couple hits.
After a couple of hits and the disease. And what are the consequences of these head injuries?
So,
through
and
sports.
And that's what we don't know.
Well,
and
what are the symptoms?
So you have your initial symptoms. And your initial symptoms for sports-based concussions are very similar for any concussion. You can initially have – you do not need to have a loss of consciousness, number one, for it to be deemed a concussion. You can have what we call an alteration in consciousness.
Mm.
That's typically a period of time that's short with some confusion, disorientation that will eventually – you know, wear off. So either one of those. There can be your typical nausea. You can have headaches, difficulty with balance, and so forth. All of these things in the majority of the population wear off relatively quickly and without any additional medical intervention needed. But as we're noticing, there are some people that have more sensitive brains. Their first concussion, they have continued symptoms. Some people, after their third or fourth, the symptoms just don't start going away. Those are your typical, I just received a concussion type of symptoms.
What kind of symptoms?
So, again, the headache, the balance issues, sometimes nausea, just sleepiness, feeling mentally foggy, those initial symptoms that can come on. The symptoms associated with chronic traumatic encephalopathy are much more distinct. There's a lot more of a mood component to them. There can be some movement issues associated with them. And these are kind of a chronic progressive illness. And so if you think of Muhammad Ali,
mm-hmm,
he is probably our first well-known person to have chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And so that's the clinical picture that you're seeing.
And he developed dementia, didn't he?
Well, they called it with him dementia pugilistica, which was basically dementia based upon him being hit so much through boxing. The term was changed to chronic traumatic encephalopathy because that also encompasses the multiple head injuries that can occur with sports as well. So with other sports such as football, soccer, hockey, and so forth. So while he was called dementia pugilistica, it actually is rolled into now this new term called chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
I remember reading an article about soccer and other sports head injuries in a popular journal, and it talked about a reduction in intelligence. Let's talk about that. Is that true?
So, and again, the studies are mixed. We recently spoke about this at our last annual conference down in Texas, and so there are a lot of factors that play into determining whether there's a loss of and basically it's how well you score on a cognitive exam.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this as well when I was in the Army. There are some biases that occur. There's for the pre-testing, you'll have some coaches. You'll also have some, you know, military supervisors that will look and they'll say, blow the first test.
Mm-hmm.
That way, if you have a head injury and you take the second one, they're not going to notice any changes. And so you can stay in the field or stay in the game.
Why would somebody want that?
So that they could stay in the field or stay in the game.
Oh, my God.
And so we had a lot of data that was skewed because people were scoring better on their second exam than their first.
But, I mean, that alone is very fascinating, that somebody would risk long-term cognitive harm in order for immediate some kind of satisfaction of getting injured again and still playing in the game.
Well, and again, there is a high... There's a high pressure, especially when you're looking at any type of professional model, because there's money involved. And there's also for any type of money that could be involved through scholarships and so forth. So you have a lot of these athletes yeah. that are under a significant amount of pressure for this performance. And in the military, same thing. There is a significant level of pressure for performance because you have to have so many boots on the ground. And so a lot of the testing, you know, there are issues with it from that standpoint.
So what about, what's your gut feeling about let's just say your average high schooler who is a soccer star or a football star or a hockey star, and they're getting multiple headbangs.
I think the best thing to look at is to understand that each person is unique. And so you may have one person who can sustain, you know, a different number of injuries than another person before they start showing any type of, you know, symptoms, especially changes in their cognitive efforts.
Yeah.
And so what I think is truly important is for us to get baseline testing for everyone.
Okay, baseline testing. So this is before?
Before any type of injury, and make it an honest baseline testing.
But how do you do that? I mean, it would be like testing the whole world.
Well, impact testing is relatively common, and it's actually very easy to do. It's it's not a pencil and paper. It's a computerized test. You can get baseline scores. And if you compare one person's baseline score with their scores afterward, there's a lot more value to that than in trying to compare one person's to another.
Of course.
And so a lot of schools, like, for instance, the Anchorage School District, anyone within high school sports has to do baseline impact testing.
Huh.
And so then afterwards they can get repetitive testing, and it can look back and measure – you know, how well they are doing compared to how they did previously.
And this is sort of like an IQ test or a cognitive ability test.
A cognitive ability test, absolutely. And it's important to educate, you know, coaches, trainers, family members, to make sure that the student understands that they really want to do well on that baseline. It's important for them to do their best each and every time so that it can be a true measure of performance and not a measure of, you know, them trying to, you know, show that they didn't have any injuries with a hit.
Well, so this is very interesting with Anchorage. So so let's say athlete has an injury, has a concussion, and then he gets his second test. He gets his post-injury test. And could there be changes significant enough that it would show up on the...
Absolutely.
Oh, and then he say, hey, look it, you're not as smart as you used to be. You better stop playing football.
Well, you hold play whenever there are any residual symptoms, and that includes cognitive. So if they're still having issues that would keep their impact scores low, you would continue to hold and do therapies with them until they would return back to their baseline.
Can they return to their baseline?
Oh, yes. In most cases, yes.
With young brains?
Well, and it doesn't necessarily. Young brains, of course, heal better than older brains. However, you also have the standpoint of the younger the athlete, the more cautious you are, because you don't know how developmentally that may change things. You know, a 6-year-old with a head injury is much different than a 16-year-old versus a 60-year-old, mm-hmm. because a 6-year-old has much more, as far as developmental milestones they need to go through mm-hmm. in order to get to their adulthood. So we're a lot more conservative the younger the athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it's really a matter of just keeping on track, making sure that from a symptom standpoint they're doing well, and making sure they're safe to return to play. And there are very stringent return to play guidelines that are in place, and there are state guidelines as far as when they can return back.
Oh, there are state of Alaska guidelines? Okay. Well, Amy, thank you. And we're not done yet. But if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Amy Murphy, a physician, a certified brain injury specialist from Providence Hospital in Anchorage. We're going to take a short music break and be right back to talk more about brain injuries. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and this is Mind Over Matter, a monthly radio show on KTOL. If you're just joining us, my guest, Dr. Amy Murphy, and I are talking about traumatic brain injury. Dr. Murphy is the medical director of the Providence Hospital Brain Injury Services, and she has a special certification, the only person in Alaska who is a certified brain injury specialist. So we have just been talking about sports injuries. And now, Amy, what I'd like to do is switch over and talk about non-sports injuries, other types of traumatic brain injury. So could you, you know, just say what are some examples of that?
Absolutely. And so, of course, you know, as we discussed earlier, sports-related concussions are getting a lot of press because of some of the things that have come out from the Players Association with the National Football League and so forth. And that being said, it's called to light more education on non-sports concussions as well. And so typical sources for non-sports concussions, a lot of which can occur in Alaska, are things such as motor vehicle accidents, snow machine accidents, ATV accidents, and simple things as far as skateboards, anything that would create a collision that would create any type of trauma to the brain. And we're finding a lot of these occur up here because of another big one, ice and falls.
Ice, yes.
Yes, so falls are also a huge source for non-sports concussions that can occur, especially in the elderly. But up here, it's all age groups because of the ice, especially over in Anchorage where I practice. And so a lot of the times you'll have people that will have multiple concussions from these non-sports concussions, or you have a mix between sports and non-sports concussions. And so in the end, you know, the brain is not necessarily very considerate of how you achieved it as much as the fact that you've had one. So
how about fights at bars? I just read that there's a really high number of people in bar fights after the bars close, both lethal and probably just being beaten up. Is that do you have a number of patients coming into the hospital for that reason?
I do. We have quite a few people that come in as far as assaults, and that can present with any level of brain injury from mild to severe, depending on the level of force used in the assault. I also have quite a few people that have been exposed to different traumas, domestic violence, childhood violence, where that really had not had any type of intervention, and I'm now seeing them as adults because they've had multiple head injuries from childhood traumas. And so I'm working with quite a few people within that population as well.
I was thinking with the aging population, loss of balance, mm-hmm. and falls. I think it was last year or year before, there was a report that Hillary Clinton had fallen in at home, and then she had some impacts of that. What was your take on that?
You know, it's been a while. I remember when they first started talking about it, and I thought to myself, oh, sounds like she had a concussion. And so, but then, of course, then the second thought of, well, I am sure she's getting excellent medical care.
Yeah. How do you do? Okay, so say you have fallen and slipped on the ice and you banged your head. Do you think everybody who has, you know, a good bang should go in and get assessed?
Well, what we typically tell people to look for, there are some symptoms that can occur that definitely are red flags. So if you have vomiting after the head injury, if you have any type of change, we call it in your neurologic status. So say if you're feeling weakness, numbness on one side, if the eyes look different, if you have difficulty maintaining your balance and so forth, if you have any type of changes, even cognitively, like you're not speaking correctly, having some confusion, you should be assessed. And there are different things that we look at, you know, we teach ER physicians to look for as far as whether or not they should do screening with CT scans and so forth. But the biggest rule of thumb I always tell people is if you are uncomfortable, go get tested.
Okay, when in doubt.
When in doubt, go get screened.
And a normal small-town hospital like Bartlett Regional would be able to do that assessment in the ER?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And that's just something that ER physicians probably are trained to do.
Absolutely. And I will point people toward there is, if you go online, Ohio State University has a great website where they've developed tools. One tool is for clinicians. The other one is for patients and families to assess whether or not they think they may have had a brain injury. And that is a great validated tool for either for anyone to use. I've been training our physicians, ER intake staff, as well as state staff to work with the OS. It's called the OSU short form. And what's great is not only do you have access to the form online, but they also have a video available to show you how to use it.
Oh.
And so in the case of somebody who's living and they don't have close access to medical care, they could actually do it, perform it themselves to determine whether or not there's a concern that there may have been a head injury that took place.
Okay. Let's talk about the assessment is done. The person's had a head injury. And let's take a look, and let's say it's a moderate to severe head injury. Let's take a look at what a person who has had a traumatic brain injury, what factors may arise, what their symptoms could be over the long haul.
Over the long haul. I will tell you that for people that I've seen with moderate and severe injuries, more often than not, there are complaints regarding cognition, and a lot of that's centered around memory. They're having difficulty with memory issues, having difficulty feeling as if they can kind of keep up with things like they used to. And so just like I will, you know, tell people, I'm like, you know, we adapt to new things. You can teach an old dog new tricks, just like, you know, more people use cell phones now than and have become used to the fact that I may not know everyone's telephone number, but I'm definitely excellent at working within an app, you know, and using a smartphone. And that's changed from when I was younger and used a rotary phone. So just as anybody with a head injury can learn new techniques for how to remember things and keep on top of their day. That's probably one of the biggest complaints that I'll hear from someone with a head injury as far as from a symptom standpoint. But more from kind of just a life standpoint, one of the biggest issues is you can just see it's not necessarily bothersome to the brain injury survivor, but there can be a pretty marked personality shift, almost to the point of where they're not the person they were before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll hear a lot from my patients, you know, I just feel like I lost my identity.
Wow, that's, I can't imagine anything bigger than that. And, I mean, how terrifying.
Yeah, and so then the goal becomes finding a purpose. And a lot of the times we just sit in the office and we talk about, you know, from within the realm of what they can do within their memory and their thinking standpoint, what can we do from it's not just a vocation at this point, but a life purpose. What can they get back into life is doing? So, and as difficult as that is for the brain injury survivor, it's as difficult as that is for the family. Because then you have families that, you know, it's a loved one, but that person they knew is not there. This is someone new. And that purpose that the person may find may not be something that is necessarily the purpose that is shared or a vision shared by a spouse, family member, loved one. And so there can be a great split. And I'll never forget, you know, my friend who told me, he said, you know, you can tell the people who are able to grow with you and the people that aren't. And he just finally moved away from where his parents were because he said every time he came home, it felt like he was walking into a surprise birthday party that was never for him.
So the parents in this case, let's say, it would be very, very hard for parents because they had an idea, a very set idea of who this person was.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, you've got this other personality. I'm also, because I have done several programs recently on dementia, and there are certainly parallels there because it is not the same person.
Right.
And it's hard not to blame the person. Why can't you do this? Because it's an invisible injury. other people may not be able to see it.
Right.
There's no physical change. Or it's like fetal alcohol syndrome, although that you're born with. So it would be, for the parent, and I'm thinking of your example, really a challenge to accept this whole new and diminished. Can we say diminished? I mean, and not as a whole new and diminished self. Because the person may not be able to function at a higher level. You know, perhaps they were an electrician, which takes a lot of cognitive ability, or a lawyer. It takes more than cognitive ability. It takes executive functioning. It takes interpersonal skills. The person could still be bright enough to be a lawyer but not have the patience. Because you said it's a personality change. And I would imagine it's usually not more pro-social. It's not necessarily for the better.
Well, and it's also not necessarily for the worse either. For the most part, you may see, especially if somebody was in a very much a highly demanding cognitive field that required a lot of education, you can see more in those cases where there's the diminishment of their abilities for work. But for the most part, it's more of a lateral move, really. The problem is, in the case of my friend, it was just that split second of him walking through the door where you saw the hope on their face that the old person would be walking in because they don't know this new one. They raised the old one.
Yes.
This is a new person. And
they bonded to the old one.
Right.
And they love the old one.
Because they raised the old one.
They raised the old one. And this new person comes in, and they're like a stranger.
Yeah. And no matter how nice and, you know, how much purpose, because he did. He found a great purpose for his life. He found what he wanted to do. He was very happy, successful, doing something that he loved. But it's still very difficult for the people to, and he just, it almost became a dichotomy of my old world, my old life that I can't remember that well, and this new life with my new friends that I have now. And there were very few people that could make the transition.
You know, we're talking about it as if it's sort of equal, and you said it's more of a lateral move.
Yeah, well, because unless they were really at a high level of education, for the most part, he was active duty military. We were both in the Navy. He's now a general contractor. So he's working a lot within the same kind of employment type ways that he could previously. But just as a person, he's a completely different person.
And how is he different?
I always joke and I'll tell him, I mean, from the standpoint, you know, he always went by his middle name, you know, and now he goes by his first name. Uh-huh. I mean, that market of a difference, you know, and so I'll laugh and I tell him, I'm like, it's not your name that bothers me as much is that you've switched political affiliations, you know? And so, I mean, but that drastic of a change.
Personality-wise,
you know, same thing. It's just, you know, two equally nice people, but two very different people.
So they're equally nice. Now, injuries often don't create happy endings. So in the few handful of cases I've worked with, and they were non-sports head injuries. They were falling on the ice and falling off a four-wheeler, that kind of thing. In the cases that I recall, the person had mood disorders. They were very difficult to live with. They were depressed. They couldn't go to college. They could before and they couldn't after. Actually, pre-post, since we didn't have a pretest, we had SAT scores. And the SAT scores were much, much lower in this case. So it was really difficult. It doesn't sound like your friend, where he could just kind of go over to another field,
right,
and be successful.
And like I said, that's often the case when you have higher education. We were both high school graduates at the time that it happened. So he had not had any higher education.
This was a teenager before college.
Right. Yeah. And you do have people that have cognitive difficulties. But then, you know, and it also depends on their access to care. Did they receive rehabilitation for that? Are they on medications that helps boost them cognitively? because those, you know, the people that I'm working with are people that we have involved with that. Now, I'll still, like, I have one gentleman I saw when I was at Georgetown who he had never in his life ever aspired to do anything like this before, but after his head injury, his goal was to write a book for other brain injury survivors. And so he's like, I've never written a book, and now I'm going into this cognitively impaired. But then we worked on strategies for him to get around getting things down on paper. And he said, of course, I have hired an excellent editor, you know. And so there are ways to move past that. And like I said, it's not just from a – we tend to think of life from a vocational standpoint as far as where you are in the pecking order. Mm-hmm. And it is so much more than that. It is truly finding a purpose. And that has nothing to do with vocation.
Well, you know how we talk about every person's brain is different, and they may have more resiliency, but also every head injury is different, and it's injuring different parts of the brain, so making generalizations is difficult. On the other hand, mood disorders would be common symptoms. I mean, first of all, depression, because you're grieving. You're grieving the loss of certain abilities. So let's talk about some of the mood disorders that may occur on a fairly long-term basis after a particular head injury.
Absolutely. And the way that the mood orders will present themselves really can also depend on the severity of the injury. When you have people that have some of the more significant injuries, one of the most common initial problems that they'll have is a lack of insight into the depth of their deficits. And so, for instance, you know, you'll have people that will come in that are so significantly impaired, they definitely should not be driving. Yet they have no understanding and cannot believe how you could think that they wouldn't be able to drive because they feel that they are perfectly fine.
Well, is it because that specific part of the brain was injured, which would that be the executive functioning?
That's the frontal lobes of the brain.
The frontal lobe. So if the frontal lobe is injured, and this happens a lot with dementia, there isn't a self-awareness.
Well, and the frontal lobes are injured quite often, especially down toward the bottom of the frontal lobes and then, of course, the temporal lobes, because those areas within the skull are rough. And so any type of movement of the brain within the skull over the frontal and temporal areas lead to increased risk for damage. Mm. So you see these injuries quite a bit. Even if somebody wasn't hit in the frontal lobes, if they were hit hard enough that their entire brain shifted, they will have frontal lobe damage. So this is a very common phenomenon we see in people after they have a significant head injury. So this lack of insight into their level of deficit, impulsivity, where they'll just, you know, basically, you know, which can be very dangerous and lead to further injury. These are some of the things that we see early on, and those can persist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as general mood disorders, you can see what we call difficulties with agitation, which is a high anxiety state enough that they can just not be able to tolerate it. It's that person who's, you know, just getting up from their chair and being like, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't. And they just can't be within that given situation without having this high anxiety agitated state. They can sometimes lead to aggression. And so those are things that you definitely want to work with family members on treating, both from a therapy standpoint as well as from a pharmaceutical standpoint. Mood is a big one. Depression and anxiety you can see a lot of, although those can also be secondary to underlying fatigue and cognitive changes. And sometimes if you treat that, those mood symptoms go away. But for the most part, you know, PTSD, there's a lot of press on that from the military, comorbid PTSD with mild traumatic brain injury. A lot of the areas that are injured within the brain during a concussion or more significant head injuries are the same centers that are disrupted with the chemical transmission for a lot of these mood disorders. And so it makes sense that there would be overlap for the symptoms.
Yes. You said fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
Why do traumatic brain injuries cause fatigue, or some do?
Actually, all neurologic conditions, any conditions for the brain can cause fatigue. So it's not just brain injury. MS, if you know anyone with multiple sclerosis, one of the most common factors in limiting them from work is the fatigue.
Right.
Because fatigue isn't anything that you can push through. This is something that basically you have hit a certain point, which many people will call hitting the wall, where you just cannot move past it without rest. And so this can occur with any type of neurologic condition, but more frequently we see it in things like traumatic brain injury as well as things like MS and so forth. You can even have some of this occur, you know, within different type of, you know, chronic degenerative neurologic diseases. But it is a very big factor because it keeps people from life.
Yeah.
And the most important thing is getting people back to life and back to their therapies and treatments. And so, you know, treating that is huge. And so if you have somebody who can't get back to life because they're so fatigued and they can't sleep because they're not able to do anything during the day, well, of course, that'll lead to depressive-type symptoms. A lot of the times, so if we take care of that and treat that, then that removes the, you know, the mood that's not an underlying mood disorder, but basically secondary to the events that are occurring.
So with a traumatic brain injury, it might be like with dementia. The disease itself is causing a lack of sleep, and then the lack of sleep could cause, obviously, depression if you're exhausted. In fact, severe lack of sleep can cause psychotic symptoms.
Correct. And lack of sleep can cause so many alternate symptoms other than just mood. But it can cause headaches, which then again can turn around and worsen mood symptoms because then you're dealing with chronic pain. So a lot of these create a vicious cycle. And so many times we, you know, the goal is to look at the entire person. You can't treat one portion of the process without looking at all of them. Because if you only treat one half, you're not catching all of the person. And they'll continue to have symptoms and continue to not feel well and not be able to return back to life.
Well, Amy, let's take another short music break. And if you have just tuned in recently, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and the program is called Mind Over Matter. And today I'm talking with Dr. Amy Murphy, a physician, a certified brain injury specialist at Providence Hospital in Anchorage. And we are talking about traumatic brain injuries and some of the symptoms. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio today is Dr. Amy Murphy, and we are talking about traumatic brain injury. Dr. Murphy is a certified brain injury specialist and works at the Providence Hospital Brain Injury Service in Anchorage. So welcome back to our listeners. Amy, one thing that I was impressed by in your talk at noon today, Amy gave a program for clinicians around traumatic brain injury, are all the treatment possibilities and the pharmacological interventions. So I really didn't know about that. What good news? Could you just kind of, we can't get too technical on this show because we're just normal people listening to it, but could you just give us a little overview of that?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing, and I hear this quite a bit, is that people are like, you know, why didn't we know that there were actually things that we could use to help treat this? And part of the problem is that, you know, until brain injury medicine became popular news, it wasn't really practiced anywhere outside of the small sphere of people that were doing it. And so a lot of these medications haven't been used by anyone outside of, you know, our general circles. And now more and more people are becoming aware of what brain injury is, and now more and more people are interested in the treatments for it. And there are plenty of treatments for it. I've had many people that have said to me, you know, I've had issues with fatigue and issues with thinking for the past 5 years, and this is the first time I've been offered treatment for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but there's great treatment for it. I think the biggest thing for anyone to know is we have excellent treatment to help with fatigue management, to help with cognition and returning, you know, memory, thinking, and so forth. Of course, you know, the amount that you get back is dependent on the level of injury, but there's always some improvement, as well as, you know, treatment for headaches. The biggest thing is trying to return people back to where they can get back, function, and have a full and enjoyable life. And we have that capability. Between medications, between therapies with physical, occupational, and speech therapy, I mean, we can get a lot accomplished. And we're working on training therapists throughout the state so that they know more of the brain injury-specific therapies, for instance, those associated with working on balance, with vision, especially eye movements, because there's vision therapy that can be done. Speech therapy, which, you know, works somewhat on speech, but most also works on higher order thinking and executive functioning as well. So those are treatments that are available and that we're training other therapists throughout the state to be able to provide. And then for the medication portions, that's why I'm doing what I do, going out and trying to teach other providers what's available so that that can be more available throughout Alaska.
Back on treatments, it sounds like it's everything from cognitive behavioral therapy to medication. There was a type of, did you call it pressure point? I'm trying to remember. There was a kind of
trigger point.
Trigger point. Could you talk about, that was new to me. Could you talk about that, please?
Absolutely. One of the biggest things that we're noticing, especially in the field for sports medicine or also non-sports, non-sports concussion, is that there tend to be a lot of neck issues that can contribute and sometimes almost look like the same symptoms that come from concussion. And so for a long time, people were kind of overlooking this and not really kind of connecting the two, that yes, things that occur within the neck with these whiplash-type injuries or these sports-type injuries actually can have an effect on balance, vision, you know, thinking, and so forth. And so you have to treat that portion as well. And so some of what we do, we can, you know, look at that through our physical and occupational therapy team. We can look at that through pain management, but one of the biggest issues that we also see is there's a prevalence of what we call trigger points, and these are tender areas that can occur within any muscle with overuse that when you press on it, it has a typical referral pattern. and some of these that occur in the upper back have typical referral patterns.
You explain referral pattern?
So it's basically probably the most common one people would think of is if you reach with one of your hands and you go up below your neck to that muscle right where your neck joins to your shoulder. That is a common area where people can have trigger points. And so you feel for a spot, and you may even have a tender spot that you can feel right now. And you're like, oh, that feels great. I'm pressing on that and getting rid of it. Mm. And that is not a trigger point unless you press that spot and you also, while pressing that spot, start to have symptoms that occur in a specific referral pattern, typically up in the head, not anywhere directly connected to that point. And when that occurs, that is a trigger point.
Mm-hmm.
And so treatment of those trigger points can be very beneficial, especially in somebody that's having consistent headaches after a head injury, because sometimes it's not from the head as much as it is from the neck.
And what kind of professionals are trained with in this trigger point therapy?
Well, actually, there are many people that can be trained in working with trigger points. I know that was part of my training in osteopathic medical school as far as the identification and treatment for the trigger points. We definitely did it in my physical medicine and rehabilitation program for my residency. And there are a lot of family physicians that do it, a lot of sports medicine physicians that do it. There are also even, there are chiropractors that do it, even some physical therapists that do it as well. And so the goal is to make sure that in every community there's at least some group that can adequately diagnose and treat and get rid of these, because it can make such a huge difference in quality of life for the person that has them.
You know, we barely touched, Amy, on the impact on the family. I mean, so it's not just the person with the head injury, but it's the family. So let's talk about maybe if you're the spouse, not the parent, but the spouse of somebody with a traumatic brain injury.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I have quite a few, because many times whenever somebody comes in for their appointment, they're being brought in by their loved one. And so you not only see the fatigue on the face of the person that has had the brain injury, but you see the fatigue on the face of the person that is caring for them.
Mm.
And there definitely is a provider burnout that can occur, especially when somebody is alone and having to provide all of the care and support for somebody with a head injury. Because not only are you looking at all of the medical appointments, therapy appointments, medication changes. This is somebody, if your spouse, they're not sleeping well. If your spouse isn't sleeping well, you're not sleeping well, and so forth. So one of the great things, I'm involved with the Alaska Brain Injury Network, and we're really trying to work on making sure that there's plenty of information for both brain injury survivors as well as their family in one spot through their website. And working through them and with Access, there are support, there are groups in each city, not only for the brain injury survivors, but for their family members as well. Because sometimes it's important to have that outreach there, too, for the caregivers.
Yes, yes. And that's why NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness, is co-sponsoring your visit. And our time has run out. Dr. Amy Murphy, I want to thank you so much for coming down to Juneau today. The weather's not bad, so that's great. And thank you for sharing your expertise about traumatic brain injuries. And I'd like to thank Jeff Brown for contributing his technical expertise to tonight's show. And I want to really especially thank Jeff for supporting me over all these years doing this program and just being there at my beck and call whenever I need to do something suddenly. Thanks to our listeners, and don't forget to join us next month on a Monday night at 7 p.m. on KTOO. Good night, folks.